Hey, I'm Nancy Cavey, National ERISA and Individual Disability Attorney. Welcome to Winning Isn't Easy. Before I get started, I have to give you a legal disclaimer. This podcast isn't legal advice. The Florida Bar Association told me that I had to say this, but nothing is ever going to prevent me from giving you an easy-to-understand overview of the disability insurance world, the games the disability carriers play, and what you need to know to get the disability benefits you deserve. So off we go. Today, I'm going to talk about fibromyalgia and objective medical findings. Now, it doesn't matter to me whether or not you have fibromyalgia or not, because I think there are lots of lessons that you can learn from this podcast about disability carriers' requirement that you have objective medical findings. I'm first going to talk about Unum's use of self-reported subjective medical condition policy language to limit ME/CFS fibromyalgia claims. I'm going to talk about how the First Circuit rejected a CPET exam, resulting in a Unum fibromyalgia win. And I'm going to talk about whether or not your ERISA policy requires that your disability claim be substantiated by significant objective medical findings. Are you ready to go? Well, before we do that, let's take a quick break because we've got a lot of information to share with you today.
Have you been robbed of your peace of mind from your disability insurance carrier? You owe it to yourself to get a copy of Robbed of Your Peace of Mind, which provides you with everything you need to know about the long-term disability claim process. Request your free copy of the book at kvlaw.com today.
Welcome back to Winning Isn't Easy. Unum uses self-reported subjective medical condition policy languages to limit the payment of benefits in CFS fibromyalgia case. So let's learn their game. Subjective complaints like body-wide pain, weakness, fatigue, and brain fog are disabling characteristics of fibromyalgia, ME/CFS. Disability carriers hate subjective medical conditions, and many policies or plans will limit how long they'll pay disability benefits based on either a self-reported symptom limitation or a subjective medical condition limitation clause that's found in their policy or plan. So let's talk about this in greater detail. If you have fibromyalgia and you're thinking about applying for your disability insurance benefits or have applied for those benefits, I think you want to know if there's a self-reported symptom, SRS, or subjective medical condition limitation clause in your policy or plan. Now, while these terms may have different names, the practical result is the same. Benefits are limited to just 2 years, regardless of how disabled you are at the end of those 2 years. So I want to give you an example. I'm going to talk about the case of Obest versus Unum Life. It's a First Circuit case, and it's a classic example of a disability carrier who disputes the fibromyalgia diagnosis and how disabling policyholder symptoms are. Now, Obest, who had chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, was paid disability benefits for over 43 months before her claim was denied under the policy's self-reported symptom limitation. The plan had provided for a maximum payment of 24 months for disabilities due to mental illness and disabilities based primarily on self-reported conditions. Now, this policy term is common in Unum policies or plans, and you want to get your policy out regardless of whether it's Unum or not and see whether or not you have a subjective medical condition policy limitation. But I will tell you that the outcome is really going to depend on where you live. Why would I say that? Well, what circuit law applies can make the difference in how the self-reported symptom or self-subjective medical condition clause is interpreted. You would think that courts across the country would uniformly interpret policy or plan terms. And if only it was that easy, I wouldn't have a job. Now, the leading case on interpreting Unum's self-reported symptom limitation is found in a case called Weissenkamp. It's a 2003 case out of the First Circuit. The court ruled that the SRS limitation only applied to illnesses that were diagnosed primarily based on self-reported symptoms rather than to illnesses for which the disabling symptoms are self-reported. Now, Obest plan was issued in Massachusetts, which is governed by the First Circuit law, court law. And the First Circuit is notoriously unfriendly to disabled policyholders. Her claim, unfortunately, was governed by the First Circuit law. The court in Ovis said that it wasn't permissible for the carrier to deny a disability claim because there was no objective basis of a diagnosis that wasn't subject to objective verification. The court said that the carrier could require objective evidence of functional limitations and declined to follow the Weissenkamp Federal Circuit law. So we had a discrepancy between two circuits. One circuit said, too bad, so sad. The other circuit was much more sympathetic to the use of self-reported symptoms in the diagnosis and establishment of restrictions and limitations. So what are the four lessons I think that can be learned from these two cases? Well, the first one is that subjective medical condition limitations are common policy limitations and that these benefits can be limited to 2 years. Secondly, disability carriers can't require objective proof of a medical condition that can't be proven by objective testing, such as migraines, headaches, fibromyalgia, ME/CFS. But the third thing we learned is that disability carriers can require objective proof of the subjective symptoms being disabling as the term disabled is defined by the policy. And the fourth thing we've learned is there's no uniform court interpretation of these terms, and the result depends on what federal circuit law applies. So if you have a subjective medical condition, get out your disability policy, read it, and if you find that clause, I think you need to immediately consult with an experienced ERISA disability attorney who will tell you what the applicable federal law is. Why would you want to do that at the time you're applying or before your claim has been denied? Because you need to know what you need to prove based on that particular circuit's requirements and interpretation of these subjective medical condition limitations. It's just a wise thing to do to save you from pain in the future. In the next segment, I'm going to talk about how the First Circuit, who we've already mentioned before, rejects a CPET examination result in a Unum fibromyalgia claim. Let's take a quick break before we head into our next segment. Welcome back to Winning Isn't Easy. First Circuit rejects a CPET examination result in a Unum fibromyalgia disability insurance claim. Many disability policies require that a disability policy holder or beneficiary provide objective evidence that their disabling symptoms are in fact causing a functional loss that results in disability, as defined by the policy or the plan. Now, it's hard to win a fibromyalgia disability claim, and complaining about the symptoms is not enough to get your disability benefits. You have the burden to prove that you have fibromyalgia and that you have disabling restrictions and symptoms that result in restrictions and limitations that meet the burden of proof. And you generally have to do that by objective evidence. Now, one of the most common ways to help prove not only the diagnosis, but the restrictions and limitations in an ME/CFS or fibromyalgia case is to undergo what's called a cardiopulmonary function test, a CPET test. Disability carriers are going to attack the results of that examination on two grounds. The two common reasons that they attack the CPET exam are crucial for you to understand. But as a preliminary, you need to understand the disability carriers hate subjective medical condition or self-reported cases. And they'll pull out of their disability carrier denial toolbox two arguments when it comes to CPET tests. The first is what I call the submaximal effort defense. If you do not give full effort throughout the test, the carrier is going to claim that the results aren't valid. In fact, they'll argue that you didn't cooperate fully, and that in and of itself is a violation of the terms of the disability insurance policy. But they will also argue that because you didn't give full effort, you're manipulating the results, and that that manipulated result doesn't really reflect your true restrictions and limitations. So you could never, ever possibly be disabled because you're manipulating the results. obviously, you want to give your best and full effort throughout the CPET exam. Now, the second argument in the Disability Carrier Denial Toolbox is that the CPET testing wasn't time relevant. Now, ideally, you should have the CPET testing before you apply for your benefits and at regular intervals during the period of the claim. That can be impossible, and it sure can be financially daunting. If your claim is denied, you should try to get a CPET examination immediately and then have your carrier endorse the results as being valid and applicable as of the date your claim was denied. I think that's one way to beat the not time relevant argument. I don't want the disability carrier to rob you of your disability benefits by you playing into these two common reasons that disability carriers will reject the CPET exam. And unfortunately, in this case, the First Circuit said, hey, we don't think this person gave full effort, and we don't think that the CPET testing was time relevant. And as a result, we're throwing out the results. We uphold the denial of this claim. The First Circuit is notoriously unsympathetic, if you will, to ERISA disability policyholders. And this is just one example of their unreasonableness and their willingness to rubber stamp ERISA disability claim denials. So let's take a break before we move on to, does your ERISA policy or plan require that your claim be substantiated by significant objective medical findings?
Are you a professional with questions about your individual disability policy? You need the Disability Insurance Claim Survival Guide for Professionals. This book gives you a comprehensive understanding of your disability policy with tips and to-dos regarding your disability application that will assist you in submitting a winning disability application. This is one you won't want to miss. For the next 24 hours, we are giving away free copies of the Disability Insurance Claim Survival Guide for Professionals. Order yours today at disabilityclaimsforprofessionals.com.
Welcome back to Winning Isn't Easy. Does your ERISA policy or plan require that your disability claim be substantiated by significant objective medical findings? Disability carriers and plans don't make it easy for you to get the disability benefits you deserve. And one of the ways they do that is by writing the policy or plan language in a way that makes it hard for you to prove your entitlement to benefits. An example of this is found in the language of FedEx disability plans. Now, I absolutely hate FedEx's disability plan. They're not, quite frankly, in my opinion, interested in really providing their employees with disability benefits. And quite frankly, I think if you can use a different delivery service, go at it. It's a convoluted plan, and it requires a FedEx employee to have an occupational disability. What on earth is that? Well, they define it as the inability of a covered employee because of a medically determinable physical impairment or mental impairment to perform the duties of their regular occupation. Well, lots of words in this definition, but the words get worse. The disability has to be substantiated by significant objective findings, which are defined as signs that are noted on a test or medical examination and which are considered anatomically, physiologically, or psychological abnormalities that can be observed apart from your individual symptoms. Another bunch of words that they will use to deny your claim. Now, the burden of proof is on the FedEx employee to substantiate their disability. Let me tell you the case of Mason versus FedEx. And I think it illustrates the almost impossible to prove standard of disability, even in the most compelling cases. Mason had worked at FedEx as a handler, non-DOT warehouse worker, and was required to lift and maneuver packages of 50 pounds. She claimed she was disabled because of complications from numerous procedures caused by scar tissue that formed after she had breast reduction surgery. She'd undergone a bilateral reduction mammoplasty that had caused scarring. In an effort to relieve the pain and tightness by the scarring, she had undergone numerous surgical laser and radiation treatments. The FedEx plan paid benefits for a couple months, and then they denied benefits because there was no functional impairment. Mason provided her medical records that documented her consistent pain complaints and her medical treatment. Her doctors opined that she couldn't lift her arms or do any lifting over 5 pounds. So Aetna, who was the plan administrator for FedEx, had her file reviewed by four liar for hire medical doctors. They all concluded she didn't offer objective evidence of functional impairment. The scars weren't good enough. The medical providers, all of whom were men, acknowledged but rejected the opinions of Mason's treating physicians. They all said she could do the lifting required. Now, one would think, as a matter of common sense, that scar tissue would impact a person's ability to lift and cause pain and tightness in the chest area. She did have full range of motion in her arms, and she didn't have any motor weakness of her arms. So the Aetna doctor said, look, there's no subjective medical findings. Now, there isn't a lot of testing that you can do to establish that the scar tissue is causing impingement in the chest area. I mean, it just doesn't exist. When the case ended up in federal court, the judge agreed and upheld the denial. And you can see, as a matter of common sense, that a person can have difficulty moving their arms out in front of them, have difficulty lifting, not necessarily because of problems with their arms, but because of the area in the chest, the front of the shoulders, over the breastbone. But because there's no objective way to test for that, the judge said, oh, well, you didn't meet the definition of disability because there's no significant objective medical findings that have been noted on testing, because there isn't any, or medical examination, because you necessarily wouldn't find any, and which are considered anatomical, physiological, or psychological abnormalities that are observed apart from the individual symptoms. I'm wondering whether the results in this case would have been different if she had undergone what's called a functional capacity evaluation, because it could have been an objective medical finding that could have been endorsed by her treating physician. But of course, we'll never know. I hope that you've enjoyed this week's episode of Winning Isn't Easy. If you enjoyed this episode, consider liking the page, leaving a review, or sharing it with your friends and family. Also, subscribe to this podcast. That way, you're going to be notified every time a new episode comes out. I hope you tune in for next week's episode of Winning Isn't Easy.